Chapter 9. An old, tired, shabby whaler, with a crow's nest aloft, trying out gear and general filth on deck and deeply squalid sides, stood in Tupa Bay, the northeastern port of Oahu in Kalahua's territory, just making headway against the ebb under a single blue-patched foretopsail. In her crow's nest stood her even shabbier master, in a blackguardly round hat crammed up against his unshaven mate, both of them gauging the wind and the distance between the two headlands on either side of the entrance. "We should get out in two tacks at slack water or on the ebb," said Jack. And they returned to their examination of the far end, where the wide, sheltered bay drew in before broadening into the harbour itself. "We shall open the narrows any minute now, sir," said Pullings. Jack nodded. "I don't see a hint of a battery on either side," he said. And then, as the narrows opened, he called down, "Mr. West, come up the sheet and drop the kedge." "Nor no privateer neither," said Pullings. "The fat round tub of a ship right down against the shore where the stream comes in is a Nootka fur trader if ever there was one." Jack nodded again. He'd had her in his glass for some time, and after a silence he said, "She must be the true love. She was hove down just there when Wainwright left her. They've come at the leak. She's crossed her yards and bent her sails, and she's riding low. Stores and water aboard for sure." "Nothing could be a better example of Dr. Falconer's general position," said Stephen, standing with Martin in the mizzen top. "The whole is volcanic, with corals superimposed here and there and lying around the edge in reefs. That mountain, that truncated cone rising behind the jagged hills, certainly has a crater at the top. It is, no doubt, the volcano he wished to explore. Indeed, there is a little cloud of what may well be smoke just over it." "Certainly. Furthermore, the extreme luxuriance of the vegetation surely implies a volcanic soil. Do but consider the impenetrable forest. I say impenetrable, but now I see a road along the stream. Then again, these strands, now coral, now lava black, argue repeated eruptions. We hear of submarine outbursts of extraordinary violence. Iceland, says Sir Joseph Banks, is blessed not only with birds so remarkable as the gerfalcon, the harlequin duck, and both phalaropes, but also with sensible volcanic phenomena at virtually all seasons. There's something I do not like about that village," said Jack. "Wainwright spoke of it as full of people, crowded, and now there are very few walking about. And they're only women and children, with here and there an old man. The canoes are all drawn up, most of them high up." Pullings was digesting this and the absence of nets spread out to dry when two girls, helped by a band of children, slid a small two-hulled canoe down the sand and put off, the girls managing the immense sail with no apparent difficulty, steering very close to the wind and travelling with extraordinary speed. Jack heaved himself out of the deep crow's nest. The topgallant masts gave a warning creak. "Take care, sir," cried Pullings. Jack frowned, let himself gently down to the crosstrees, reaching out for a standing backstay, and shot down to the quarterdeck like a well-controlled meteor, landing with a thump and hands just this side of the scorching point. "Pass the word for Owen," he said. And to Owen, "Hail the canoe in the South Seas as it approaches the Narrows. Hail it very civil."
"Very civil it is, sir," said Owen.
Yet he had no time to make his compliment, for in their friendly Polynesian way the girls hailed them first, smiling up and waving a free hand. "Ask them to come aboard," said Jack. "Mention feathers, coloured handkerchiefs." Words passed. But the girls, though amused and half tempted by feathers and coloured handkerchiefs, didn't choose to come up the side. And to be sure, the few visible surprises looked deeply unappetizing. Nevertheless, they stayed long enough to make three rings about the ship, handling their craft with a skill that was a joy to behold, and to answer the question, "Where is the Franklin?" "Gone to chase a ship." "Where are all the men?" "Gone to war." "Kalahua is going to eat Queen Buolani. He's taken the gun." Their third remark, though shrill and high, was uttered by both at once, and much of what might have been comprehensible was lost in the wind as they sped off. But it seemed to tell the surprises, who at this point were sailing under American colours, that they would find their friend in Oahu when the Franklin had caught her ship. "The True Love is lowering down a boat, sir," said Pullings. "An 8-oared cutter. And although some of those that lowered it were sailors, those that came down into the stern sheets were obviously landsmen." Jack considered them and their ship, their thinly manned ship, for some time as the cutter made its way from the shore. "Mr. West," he said, "let all boats be ready at a moment's notice. Mr. Davidge," calling down the hatch, "stand by." Davidge was in command of the flying column, armed and prepared for any emergency that might arise, and kept below decks where they fairly stifled. He then recovered the kedge, hauled the sheet aft, and stood on through the narrows, looking very attentively at the country between the village and the mountains, where the stream came towards the harbour. When the cutter was within hail, a man stood up, fell down, stood up again, holding the coxswain's shoulder, and called, "What ship is that?" in an approximately American voice, drawing his face in a sideways contortion to do so. "The tide is out. Where is Mr. Dutord?" "Gone a-chasing. He'll join us in Oahu in 3-4 days. Do you have any tobacco? Any wine?" "Sure, come aboard." With the wheel in his own hand, Jack stood on past the cutter and turned so that the surprise lay between the boat and the shore. Speaking to the quartermaster, one of the few hands on deck, he said quietly, "When they hook on, hoist our own colours." It was a sophistry. The colours, streaming directly towards the shore, would be seen neither by the True Love nor by a boat attached to the Surprise's windward main chains, but certain forms had to be observed. The man who hailed and three others from the stern sheets came awkwardly up. They had pistols in their belts. So had the man they left behind. They were not seamen. The canvas strips that concealed most of the ship's guns didn't surprise them, nor did her whaling gear, improbable when seen close at hand. "The Liberator said we should soon have wine and tobacco," said the leader, smiling as pleasantly as he could. "Mr. West," said Jack, "pray tell Mr. Davidge that these gentlemen are to be properly served. Bilbo's in the forehold might be most suitable. Go with him, Bondon," he added, feeling that perhaps West might not have grasped the point of the last murmured words. In point of fact, everybody aboard, apart from these wretched white or whitish mercenaries, was aware of Captain Aubrey's motions, even Stephen and Martin, newly arrived from the mizzen-top. And when Jack, seeing Bondon return with a satisfied smile, said in an undertone, "Doctor, pray get that ugly fellow in the stern-sheets to come aboard," he needed no explanation, but called out in French, asking for news of Monsieur Dutord's health and suggesting that the man should climb carefully up the side with a mariner or two capable of carrying heavy weights. One of the mariners he pointed to, stroke oar, had been gazing up for some time very earnestly, making discreet nods and becks, and Stephen was almost sure he was one of 1,000 former patients. The mercenary came up with no further persuasion, and stroke oar after him. The seaman, having saluted the quarter-deck, instantly gave the mercenary a truly frightful kick that hurled him with stunning force against the capstan. Bondon took his pistol away as though they'd practised the act for weeks, and the seaman, turning to Jack, pulled off his hat and said, "William Hoskinson, armourer's mate in Polycrest, now belonging to the True Love." "I'm heartily glad to see you again, Hoskins," said Jack, shaking his hand. "Tell me, are there many other Frenchmen in the True Love?"
"About a score, sir. They was left behind to keep us at work and to stop the natives from stealing when the others went off to war with Kalahua. They cut capers over us something cruel and spoke sarcastic, those that could speak any English."
"Are the rest of the boat's crew True Loves?"
"All but the coxswain, sir. And I dare say they've scragged him by now, a right bastard. He killed our skipper."
Jack glanced over the side, and there indeed were the True Loves, busily, silently drowning the coxswain. From a sense of duty, Jack called out, "Belay there!" And they belayed, coming aboard as nimbly as cats for a glass of grog served out on the half-deck.
"We smote you as no right whaler from the shore," said one of them to Killick. "But did we tell them infernal buggers? No, mate, we did not."
During this time, the Surprise had let fall her topsail and she was making for an anchorage close inshore on the south side of the harbour. The cutter was towing alongside and her own boats were in a high state of readiness for lowering down. "Mr. Davidge," said Jack, "it is of the first importance that you and your men should be on that road into the mountains, that road by the stream, before any of the Frenchmen from the True Love. They're almost certain to run once we show them our guns, and if they get to Kalahua, we're dished. He and his men are only a day's march away, perhaps not so much, seeing they're trying to drag a gun." Even in a frigate as well worked up as the Surprise, the order, "Man and arm boats," was really carried out in under 25 minutes, the system of tackles to the fore and main yardarms being so cumbrous. And the launch was scarcely in the water before the Frenchmen in the True Love had grown suspicious. They were gathering on the shore and moving through the village southwards along the stream, carrying bundles. The launch and blue cutter were already full of men, however, and Jack called, "Go ahead with what you have, Mr. Davidge, and do your best to hold them until the rest come up."
"I shall do my very best, sir," said Davidge, looking up and smiling. "Shove off! Give way!"
The boats raced for the shore and ran far up the sand. The men bundled out, holding their muskets high, and almost at once they disappeared into the tree ferns. When the other cutter and the gig were on their way, Jack hurried up into the foretop. The deep belt of tree ferns thinned out to a country of tall grass scattered with bushes and small but very thick patches of wood full of lianas. The column could be seen here and there, still in reasonable formation, but much drawn out, the leading men doing their best to keep up with the extraordinarily agile Davidge. Their muskets gleamed in the sun and their cutlasses as they slashed at the lianas in the undergrowth. The Frenchmen had now started running too, throwing down their bundles, but not their arms. They, like Davidge, were clearly aiming for the point where the stream broke out of the mountains in a narrow gorge. And although the distance from the column's landing place to the gorge was much the same as that from the village, the Frenchmen had the advantage of the road cut for the gun. "Even so," said Jack, clasping his hands with great force, "we had half an hour's start." The line was becoming still more drawn out, Davidge going like a thoroughbred. He was running not indeed for his life, but rather for his living, for all that made life worthwhile. The other boats had now landed their men, and they were tearing along the track already made. The tree ferns could be seen waving as they passed. "Oh, no! Oh, no!" he cried, as a body of Surprises, outstripped, tried to catch up by forcing their way straight through a brake crisscrossed with thorny creepers. "Would God I'd gone with them," he said. And he was about to lean over and call, "Tom, try a long shot at the Frenchman on the road," when he realised that the sound of the gun would act as a spur, doing certain harm for almost no likelihood of good. The Surprises had now come to fairly clear country, and the two lines were converging fast. Davidge had reached the stream. He was across it. He climbed the far bank and stood in the gorge facing the three leading French, his sword in his hand. He ran the first through the body, pistoled the second, and the third brought him down with a clubbed musket. From that moment on it was impossible to make out particular actions. More Surprises hurled themselves across the stream, more Frenchmen came up the road as fast as they could run. Dust rose over the close fighting, the hand-to-hand battle in the gorge. There was a steady crackle of musket fire as the reinforcements came up, taking the Frenchmen from behind and picking off those who were not yet engaged or those few who tried to run back.
The shouting died. The dust settled. It was clear that Davidge's men had won. Jack took the ship across to lie alongside the True Love, landed in the jolly boat with Stephen, Martin and Owen to interpret, and walked fast along the road towards the gorge. He was silent, more exhausted than if he'd taken part. It was a small group they met, men of Davidge's division carrying his body.
"Was anyone else killed?" asked Jack. "Harry Weaver copped it, sir," said Paget, captain of the foretop. "And William Brimer, George Young and Bob Stewart were so badly hurt we durstn't move them. And there are some more of their mates, sir, helping down at the boats."
"Did any French survivors get away?"
"There weren't no survivors, sir."
By the height of flood, everything was laid along. The wounded had been brought down. The True Loves, who had taken refuge in a Puahonua, a sanctuary so profoundly taboo that even Kalahua wouldn't allow the French to violate it, had been recovered. And the Surprise, followed by the True Love, had warped across the harbour to the northern side of the Narrows, waiting for the first of ebb to waft them through. As Stephen came into the cabin, Jack looked up and said, "How are your patients coming along?"
"Tolerably well, I thank you.
At one time I was doubtful about Stewart's leg. I even reached for the saw, but now I believe that with the blessing we may save it. The rest of our people are mostly straightforward cut or stab wounds, though some poor fellows from the True Love are in a sad way. Is there any coffee in that pot?"
"I believe so. I hadn't the heart to finish it. I'm afraid it may be cold."
Stephen poured his cup in silence. He knew how Jack hated watching a battle rather than take part in it, and how he would brood over orders he might have given. Ideal orders that would have meant victory at no cost to his own people. "But at least I can give you some good news," Jack went on. "One of the True Loves from the taboo place was born in the Sandwich Islands. Tapia is his name, a chief's son, intelligent. Speaks uncommon good English. And he knows these parts very well. He it was that told the others about the Puhunua when they had to cut and run after their captain and his mate were killed. And he says he's confident that once we get out, if we get out, he can pilot us through the reefs. I'm amazingly glad of it, because although Wainwright's chart's a good one, picking up his bearings on a moonless night would be a damned anxious business."
"Sha," said Killick, coming in with a tray, "which I've brought you a potney decanter."
"God shield you from death, preserved Killick," said Stephen. "I could do with both faith, so I could. And would your honour like some hot water?"
"Perhaps I should," said Stephen, looking at his hands, which were gloved over with brown, dried blood. "That's a curious thing, but although I nearly always clean my instruments, I sometimes forget my person."
Washed, and drinking coffee and brandy in alternate sips, he said, "But tell me, brother, why should you wish to grope through the darkness? The sun always rises. There's not a moment to be lost. Kalahua means to attack on Friday in the morning, whether he can get his gun there in time or not. His god says he cannot fail."
"How do you know?"
"Tapia told me. He had it from his sweetheart, who brought him food in the Puahonua and all the news. If we do not get out on this ebb and with this moderate backing wind, we may lose essential days. We may even have to wait for the change of the moon. What I hope, what I very much hope to do, is to run down to Oahu by Wednesday, tell Puolani that she is about to be attacked and that we shall defend her against Kalahua and the Franklin if she will promise to love King George, and so make our arrangements to deal with either or both with at least a day in hand."
"Very good."
Stephen considered for a while and then asked, "What have you learned of the Franklin?"
"It appears that although Dutourne is no great seaman, he now has a Yankee sailing master, as they say in America, who is. The ship is a flyer, and he drives his people very hard. Of course, with only 22 9-pounders, a broadside of 99 pounds, she's scarcely a match for us, with 168, not counting carronades.
But a fight at sea can turn on one lucky shot, as you know very well, and I had much rather not have to cope with her and perhaps her prize at the same time as Kalahua. I ought to have said, by the way, that Dutourde took all his seamen out of the True Love to run after this chase, so he would have plenty of hands to serve his guns. Come in. If you please, sir, said Mr. Reed, Mr. West says the tide is on the turn. They waited until the gentle current had grown to a stream that gurgled round their stern and tightened the hawsers from ship to shore so that they rose above the surface almost straight in a low, dripping curve, and the palm trees, which acted as bollards, lent still more. Let go, called Jack, and the two ships moved smoothly out through the narrows. The wealth of precautions, towline to the launch anchored out in the bay to heave her head to windward if she sagged, hands poised to fend her off the rock, a complication of lines to the True Love, proved unnecessary. They both passed through with 10 yards to spare and instantly flashed out topsails to gather way enough to go about on their first leg. The Surprise had a remarkably clean bottom even now, and she'd always been brisk in stays. She came round easily. But Jack, watching the deep-laden, bluff-bowed True Love, had a horrible feeling that she wasn't going to manage it. And that since there was no room to box off, still less to wear, Tom Pullings would have to club-haul her. A perilous manoeuvre with an unknown crew. The critical moment passed, and with it his extreme anxiety. She filled on the starboard tack. She was round, and the Surprises would have joined the True Love's cheer. She was an uncommonly valuable prize. If Davidge's body hadn't been lying there, sewn up in a hammock with 4 cannonballs at his feet and an ensign over him. The next tack took them clear of the harbour, though the True Love was within biscuit toss of the headland. Tapia's sweetheart, who had kept pace in her canoe, said goodbye, and he took the ship along the landward side of the reef and so through the dogleg passage, the True Love following. Here, in the fading light, they both heaved to the kind and steady wind. Aboard the Surprise, the ship's bell tolled. Martin said the proper, deeply moving words. Men from Davidge's division fired 3 volleys, and his body slid over the side. They filled again, past 2 small islands with their attendant reefs. Tapia pointed out their bearings against the dark peaks of Oahu, and then they were in the open sea. Oakes took the first watch, and while he was on duty, Stephen came on deck to breathe. The air of the sick berth, in spite of the windsels, was uncommonly fetid. Apart from the heat and the numbers, 2 of the rescued True Loves had shockingly neglected and mortifying wounds. Clarissa was sitting there in the light of the stern lantern, and for a while they talked about the extraordinary phosphorescence of the sea. The wake stretched away in pale fire until it joined the True Love's bow wave, and the brilliance of the stars in the black, black sky. Then she said, Oakes was very deeply grieved not to be one of the landing party, and I'm afraid Captain Aubrey was sadly upset by the casualties.
He was indeed.
Yet you are to observe that if fighting men, accustomed to battle from their youth, were to mourn for their companions as long as they might in civil life, they would run melancholy mad. Oakes came aft. He said, Give you joy of our prize, Doctor. I've scarcely seen you since we took her. It is true that the True Love's guns were all spiked. So I understand, all but one. Tapia told me that Captain Hardy and his mates were spiking the last when the Frenchmen killed them. How do you spike a gun? Asked Clarissa. You drive a nail or something of that kind down the touch hole so that the flash of the priming don't reach the charge. You can't fire the gun till you get the spike out, said Oakes. It appears that they used steel spikes, which the Franklin's gunner couldn't deal with. He was going to try drilling new touch holes when they went off in chase of the ship they are still pursuing, said Stephen. 2 bells. All's well, cried the lookouts round the ship, and Oakes went forward to receive the quartermaster's report of Six knots, sir, if you please,
and to chalk it on the logboard. Coming back, he said, I know it ain't genteel to talk about money, sir, but I must say the prize couldn't have come at a better moment for Clarissa and me. He spoke with a touching earnestness, and by the light of the stern lantern, Stephen caught a look of tolerant affection on her face. All the hands are busy reckoning their shares. The True Love's merchant's clerk told them the worth of the cargo to the last penny, and Jemmy Duck says the little girls may get close on £9 apiece. They walk about scarcely touching the deck and thinking of presents. You, sir, are to have a blue coat lined with white, whatever it may cost.
Bless them, said Stephen, but I didn't know they formed part of the ship's company.
Oh, yes, sir. The captain rated them boys third class long ago, so that Jemmy might have their allowance to ease his spirits.
Oh, cried Clarissa, what is this?
She held up a writhing, viscous object.
A flying squid, said Stephen. If you count, you will find he has 10 legs.
Even if he had 50, he would have no business spoiling the front of my dress, she said quite mildly. Fly off, sir, tossing it over the rail. With the breeze steady on their larboard quarter, they went easily along under single-reefed topsails, sitting in their island of lantern lights surrounded by darkness, and talking in a desultory, amiable fashion, bell after bell, while the wind sang in the rigging, the blocks creaked rhythmically, and the ritual cries were repeated at their due intervals. Halfway through the watch, Oakes left them.
I am happy to have this chance of speaking to you, said Stephen, because I should like to ask you whether you would welcome the opportunity of going home, of returning to England.
I've hardly thought about it, said Clarissa. My only wish was to get away from New South Wales, away rather than to anywhere.
I haven't really thought at all.
The present, with all its inconveniences, seemed to me the natural present. And if I had not, with great perseverance, contrived to make myself so generally disliked, I could think of nothing better than sailing on and on and on.
Dear Clarissa, collect yourself. I must be back in the sick berth very soon.
Suppose Captain Aubrey were to send this prize away under the command of Mr. Oakes, would you rejoice at the thought of seeing England again?
Dear Doctor, pray consider.
Of course I should like to be in England again, but I was transported. And if I were to return before my time, I might be taken up and sent back again, which I couldn't bear. Not, I believe, as a married woman. And if you were to keep away from St. James's Street, the likelihood of your being recognised is less than that of your being struck by a thunderbolt. And even in that case, I have connections who are, as it were, lightning conductors. I am speaking to you in this fashion, Clarissa, because I believe that you are a discreet and honourable woman, one who has a friendship for me as I have a friendship for her, one who understands the value of silence. If you return, I will give you a letter to a friend of mine who lives in Shepherd Market, a good, decent man who would like to hear all that you told me and more, and it would certainly protect you in the extraordinarily unlikely event of your being taken up. After a long silence, Clarissa said, to be sure, I had rather be in England than anywhere else. But what can I do there? As you know, a midshipman has no half pay, and I couldn't go back to Mother Abbott's. Not now.
No, never in life.
There's not the least question of that at all. Captain Aubrey has considerable influence with the Admiralty, my friend more still, and if between them they do not get Oakes a ship at once, he having passed for lieutenant, you would set up house with him for a while. If they succeed, why, sure, you might feel lonely, as perhaps my wife does when I am at sea, and you might stay with her. She has a vast great house
in the county, whatever county it is, behind Portsmouth. Far too big for a woman, and she alone, apart from our little Bridget and a few servants and the horses. She breeds Arabians. He spoke a little at random. Clarissa was clearly troubled, and she probably didn't attend. Yes, she said, but suppose I'd done something wrong in Botany Bay. Suppose I had committed a capital crime, like throwing a baby down a well, for example, and suppose that, finding me gone, they had sent word to England. Might I not be sent back for trial? Listen, my dear. With ifs, you can put all Paris into a bottle. The protection I offer you will, with reasonable discretion on your part, cover you from a multitude of sins, many or even most of them capital. Here is Pardine, his soul to the devil, and I must go. Think of what I have said. Now, speak to no one. The whole thing is a mere hypothesis, since I may not persuade the captain. Tell no one at all what I have said, and let me know yea or nay with a look in the morning. Come and be examined if ever there's time. I'm away. God bless now. It was morning before he reached the quarter-deck again. A brilliant morning, with the sun well up and green land ending in Yahoo Point all along the starboard beam. Tapia was at the foremast head, guiding the ship through the passage in the southeastern reef. All clear now, sir, he hailed. 9 fathom water all the way till you open the bay. He came down and continued his conversation with the two canoes that had been alongside for some time, and Jack noticed the jolly boat shove off from the True Love's side with his armourer in it. Come up the sheet a trifle, he said, to check the frigate's way. Vain words, attentive hands had already done it. Which the coffee's getting cold, said Killick, and the squids won't be worth eating. Mr. Smith wishes to tell you that the armourer has unspiked all the True Love's guns, said Pullings, coming across the deck and taking off his hat. The information came down the chain of command to the armourer, who stepped forward, wheezing and chuckling, gave Jack a handkerchief full of spikes, all with an internal screw thread tapped into the thick end and all glistening with sweet oil. I learned that ploy in the old Illustrious, he said, chuckling still. And it was an illustrious deed, too, said Jack. Well done, Rogers, upon my word. Good morning, Doctor. You couldn't have timed your arrival better. We have fried squids for breakfast. The squids dispatched, the proper inquiries after the sick berth made, and a fresh pot of coffee begun, Jack said quietly. It may seem flying in the face of Providence to talk about what to do after a battle before you've fought it, but some things, like preventer stays, have to be laid on beforehand, although in the event they may not prove useful. So I will say this. The gunroom's problems would be best resolved if I were to send Oakes in with the prize. But what would his wife think of it? I don't want to order that good, modest young woman back if she don't choose to go. What do you think? You know her so much better than I do. I cannot tell. But I shall be seeing her later in the morning, and I'll endeavour to find out. When do you propose to land? Not until after dinner. I'm letting the canoes come alongside and gossip so that Queen Poulani will know everything about us and what is afoot. She'll not be caught unprepared. It's a dreadful thing to have a whole carriage full of people draw up at your door and leap out grinning, the house all ahoo, carpets taken up, a great washing going on, the children bawling, yourself confined to the head having taken physic, and your wife gone to Pompey in hopes of a new cook. The Queen was not to be caught unprepared, nor was the surprise or her people. The quarterdeck carronades, so much lighter than long guns and at short range so much more deadly, were made ready for carrying ashore together with powder and shot, mostly case shot in canisters of 24 pounds apiece. The ship's blackened sea-service muskets were blackened again, the seamen's natural propensity to polish having made them shine more than they should, as Jack had noticed at Pabe. And now, considering the country before him and all that Tapia had to say about it, he had fair expectations of laying an ambush. Pikes, bayonets, boarding axes, cutlasses, pistols and murdering pieces were all laid neatly out on the one hand, only waiting the order to go ashore, and on the other bandages, splints, surgical needles and waxed thread, silk or hemp. The civil side was naturally of great importance too. Presents, a large looking-glass, feathers, pattern cloth, cut-glass decanters, had been laid in a sandalwood chest, while a crown apiece, with King George's head ringed and hung from a sky-blue ribbon, lay in Jack's pocket. And the officers, knowing the Polynesians' great regard for rank, set out silver-buckled shoes, white silk stockings, breeches, fine coats and cocked hats, and the captain's bargemen put by their uniform dress of white trousers, light blue brass-buttoned jackets and neat little pumps with bows, agony to wear on feet long flattened by bare contact with the deck. Because of the heat, and for fear of dirtying them, however, none of these things were put on until the surprise, followed by the True Love and accompanied by many canoes, rounded to opposite Yahoo, brought up in 5 fathom water, and flashed out a fine display of bunting. During this long interval, Clarissa came to see Stephen, and for a while they talked of her health, each feeling shy of approaching yesterday's conversation. He said, "I am better pleased with you today than ever I've been before. I shall leave off the mercury, which will do away with the slight salivation you mention. It is, as you know, specific for the malady you dreaded. But Dr. Redfern was quite right in his diagnosis, and I exhibited only to clear up the trouble for which you first consulted me. It's done its work, but I think we must continue the steel and bark for a little while to consolidate the general improvement." "I thank you, dear doctor, for your very great care of me," she said, and sat with folded hands for a while before going on. "I have thought about returning to England, as you desired me to do. And if the possibility were to arise, I should very much like to go back."
"My dear, I am heartily glad to hear you say so. The possibility has arisen. At breakfast this morning, Captain Aubrey said that he had it in mind to give your husband the True Love to take in, but he hesitated on your account, being unsure how you would like it. He asked me to sound you. I was so nearly certain that you would say yes that I have already prepared a letter from my friend. His name is Blaine, Sir Joseph Blaine, and he has a place under government. I must apologise for its being sealed, a necessary proof of its authenticity. In it I have told him nothing of your childhood and youth, only that you were employed to keep the accounts at Mother Abbott's. He is as well acquainted with the place as I, and that you knew a great deal about what went on in the house.
Did you tell him how I came to be sent to Botany Bay?"
"I said that a member of Black's, Sir Joseph too is a member, begged you off, and that is enough for him. He is discretion itself, the very heart of discretion, and you need fear no impertinent questions from him, no personal questions at all. If you will tell him all that you told me about Ray and Ledwood and their friends, he will be satisfied. And here," holding up a small parcel, "is a small parcel of beetles for him. He is passionately devoted to beetles, and nothing could be better to guarantee your good faith. You don't mind beetles, my dear?"
"I don't mind them at all. Indeed, I've sometimes tried to help them climb a stone, but always in vain," said Clarissa.
"Very good. I do hate women that cry out, 'Oh, beetles, oh, serpents, oh, mice, oh, centipedes,' and long to knock their silly affected heads together. But now, my dear,
Things are likely to move very fast, and we may neither of us have time to talk at our leisure. So let me tell you one or two things of importance. You will certainly go by way of Batavia, where the prize will be condemned and sold, and you will both travel to England in an Indiaman from Canton. Here is a letter to my banker in Batavia, who will provide you with funds to travel in something resembling comfort. And since East Indiamen usually put their passengers down in or near the Thames, here is a draft on my infamous London bankers that will tide you over until Mr. Oakes can come at his pay and prize money. How very... A small loan between friends is no great thing, my dear. And here is a note from Mrs. Broad, who keeps a comfortable inn in the Liberties of the Savoy. I've mentioned her before. You would do well to stay there and send a note by ticket porter to Sir Joseph Blaine, asking for an appointment in the evening and going there by hackney coach. You needn't be afraid of him. He's appreciative of tender young charms, but he is no satyr. You'll not forget the Beatles, Clarissa. And lastly, here is a letter for my wife. If Mr. Oakes passes for a lieutenant and is appointed to a ship, which I think will be the case, I believe she will ask you to stay with her until we return from the seas. I hesitate to say anything about Mr. Oakes's discretion. You may rely upon it, said Clarissa with a curious smile, partly because he knows, really knows, nothing, and partly because the rest of her words were drowned in a violent roaring above their heads, a piping and a rush of feet. Jesus, Mary and Joseph! Cried Stephen. He whipped off his canvas shoes and trousers, drew on the fine breeches laid out. She tucked his shirt in behind and fastened the strap, folding and pinning his neckcloth, put his sword belt over his shoulders, held out his best, though still sadly shabby, coat, straightened his wig and passed his hat. God bless you, my dear, he said, and ran on deck, where a great voice was calling, Hell and death, where is the doctor? Will no one rouse me out that doctor? They pulled ashore through the rows of Puolani's great double-hulled war canoes. Jack and Pullings in a blaze of gold lace and epaulettes, the others in their respective degrees of glory, and they were received with a stately, formal welcome. For although the True Love was an old friend, nothing like the Surprise had been seen in these waters, with a crow's nest like a whaler, but with no whaleboat at all, and far, far too many guns. Jack and Pullings, with Stephen and Martin Oakes and Adams, with Bondon carrying the sandalwood chest, and Tapia to interpret, paced up in twos from the sea, through ranks of elderly, grave-faced men holding fern-palm fronds, towards a wide, open-walled building where a woman was sitting on a broad bench that ran the whole width of the house with several islanders on either side of her. Jack noticed that, whereas she was wearing a splendid feather cloak, all the others, old men, young men, women and girls, were bare to the waist. When they were within 10 yards of her, an ancient man, remarkably tattooed and with a white bone through the septum of his nose, gave Jack the leafy branch of a breadfruit tree. The last men of the line threw down their fronds, and Tapia said, That is a sign they mean peace. If you put yours on top, that shows you mean peace too. Jack laid the branch solemnly over the fronds. The woman stood up, as tall as Jack and broad-shouldered, but not nearly as heavy. This is Queen Puolani, said Tapia, taking off his shirt. Jack made his bow, his hat tucked under his left arm and elegant legs stretched out. She stepped forward, shook his hand in the European manner, a firm, dry clasp, and led him in, seating him next to herself. He named the others by order of rank, and she inclined her head to each, a welcoming, friendly smile on a handsome face, no darker than an Italian's, and scarcely tattooed at all. perhaps 30 or 35. There were some 40 people, men and women, sitting in this pleasant, airy place. And when all the newcomers were settled, there followed an exchange of compliments. A meal was proposed. Jack excused himself, they had just eaten, but happily accepted the suggestion of Carver, and while it was handing round, he called for the presents. They were well received, particularly the smaller bunches of feathers that, on Tapir's whispered advice, he offered to the aunts and cousins of Pualani's house. She herself and her counsellors were clearly too anxious to pay very much attention to beads or even looking-glasses. It was also obvious, from the general course of the conversation, that many of her inquiries were a matter of form. From what her people had learnt from their friends in the True Love and from other sources, she knew most of what had happened, and asked only out of politeness. Presently she sent most of the people away, accompanying some various distances across the square before the house, others to the threshold, while others were dismissed with a smile, and the assembly was reduced to Pualani and two councillors, Jack, Stephen, and Tapir. When Jack said, "Callahua is about to attack you with the help of the Americans," she replied, "We know. He has reached the Oratonga Spring, the river that flows into our bay, with 37 white men. They have muskets and a gun. A gun. They may be here early the day after tomorrow." "So I've heard," said Jack. "As for the gun, he may have dragged it up, but without a road he may never be able to drag it down. Nothing so cumbrous as a gun. Yet, even if he should, it's no great matter. We have many more guns, bigger and better. Many, many more muskets. I must tell you, Mum." "Put that as civil as ever you can, Tapir, do you hear me? I must tell you that the Americans are my king's enemies. The two states are at war, and that we shall guard you from them and from Callahua, who has misused our countrymen, if you will accept King George's protection." "Is that how I should put it, Stephen?" "And promise to be a faithful, loving ally." The Polynesians brightened amazingly. After a few words with the old chiefs, Pualani turned to Jack with sparkling eyes and a glowing face. The flush was clearly perceptible, and said, "I welcome King George's protection, and I shall be a faithful, loving ally, as faithful and loving as I was to my own husband." Tapir translated the last words, added perhaps as an afterthought with a particular flatness, and the councillors looked down. "What a handsome creature she is," thought Jack. And he said, "Very well, that is settled. Allow me to give you your protector's likeness." He brought the shining crown from his pocket, but after a pause for the translation, hung it round her acquiescent neck. "Now, ma'am," he said, rising and looking at her with respectful admiration, "if I may speak to your war chiefs, we may start getting some of our guns ashore and making our preparations. There's not a moment to be lost." Not a moment was lost. By sunset, both ships were moored outside the bay under the lee of its southern headland, in good holding ground and completely invisible from the hills over which Callahua must come. And although the emplacements had been chosen, even the carronades were not to be landed until dusk, in case some advanced party should see them being rolled up the open strand before reaching the impenetrable green. And by sunset, Jack had explored the traditional battlefields, three places along the only route across the mountains for a considerable body of men, above all for men pulling a gun. "I'm so sorry you had to stay with your patients," he said, taking his ease at last in the great cabin with a bowl of fruit to quench his thirst. "You would have rejoiced in the birds. There was one with a beak. That alone would have been worth the voyage. A yellow bird with a heavy great beak shaped like a sickle, and many others. You would have been delighted. However, you shall see them later. Well, now, There were three main battlefields by land. The first is a grassy plain between the sudden precipitous hills and the cultivated ground. There the southern people wait for the northerners, and they draw up in lines, throw spears and slingstones, and then go over one another with clubs and the like in the old-fashioned way. But there is the disadvantage of three taboo groves. And if anyone passes within hand's reach, either pursuing or being pursued, he brings defeat on his side, and his soul, together with the souls of all those related to him, spend eternity in that volcano up there. Is it active? Pretty active, I believe. Then the next place is quite high up, a natural cleft of rather better than a cable's length, with remarkably steep sides. When our friends here learn that the northerners are coming, they usually send a squadron of war canoes up to Pabé. They're better at sea than on land. While another body hurries to this cleft and throws up a dry stone wall. They're amazingly quick and skillful, and they have the stone at hand. Sometimes they hold it, being picked men. Sometimes they're overwhelmed, the attackers having the advantage of the slope. But even if that does happen, the southerners rarely suffer much, since the men from Pabé have to hurry back because of the war canoes. The third place is where the really decisive battles have been fought. It is higher still, on a desolate lava plain flanked with cliffs. It has a damned unpleasant sulphurous smell, and it's still littered with whitened bones. I saw absolutely hundreds of skulls, perhaps thousands. May I ask what you mean to do? Oh, it's the cleft every time. Kalahua knows that Pualani cannot send her war canoes to Pabé with the Franklin likely to appear at any moment. He can use his whole force, demolish the wall at once if he's brought his guns so far, and in any case push on without fear. I'll draw you the cleft. There, about 200 yards long and 20 wide, room for Kalahua and all his men. My idea, I must repeat that they're astonishing hands at dry stone building, is to post two carronades here at the north entrance, hidden by walls, four more at the southern end, spaced out thus, and similarly hid, two firing straight down, and two, like those at the far end, firing diagonally. Quite a slight angle, but enough to sweep the whole ground. I post a few of Pualani's people just beyond the cleft. When Kalahua comes up, they skirmish a little to concentrate his men and then run hellfire quick back towards us, drawing the northerners into the cleft. When they're in, the guns at the far end open fire. The northern rear presses hard up against its own van and the guns at the southern end open up. Have the northerners no retreat? None. He'd imagined it was a military maxim that the enemy should always be left a line of retreat. Perhaps that's so in the army, but the navy's required to take, sink, burn or destroy. Pray don't look so low, Stephen. After all, the man who starts a war only gets what he asked for, you know, if he's destroyed. And he can always call for quarter. When Stephen had returned to the sick berth, Jack sent for Oakes and said, "Sit down, Mr. Oakes. As you know, tomorrow we shall be preparing to support Queen Pualani against the people from Pabé and the Americans. Captain Pullings and I and Mr. West and most of the warrant officers will be on shore, and we shall probably sleep there some way up the country. You will remain on board in command of the ship and Mr. Reed of the prize. If, during my absence, the American privateer Franklin should make as if to enter the bay, you are both to hoist our colours and engage her. But at no greater distance than a quarter of a mile, I shall leave you enough men to fight one side with the gunner's mate to assist you. If you are obliged to slip rather than weigh your anchors, which is probable should the American appear, you are to buoy them with the utmost care. Should the Franklin withdraw, she is not to be pursued beyond a line joining the two headlands. I cannot emphasise that point too strongly, Mr. Oakes. Have you any questions? No, sir. But may I say, sir, may I say with all respect that I never had a go at Pabé. I never had a go at what you might call... I never had a go at regaining your esteem. No. It is true, I was angry with you for bringing Mrs. Oakes aboard. But since then you have behaved in a seaman-like, officer-like fashion, and I think highly enough of your qualities to make you prize master of the True Love, with orders to take her to Batavia to be condemned if the encounter goes as we wish, and if you feel competent to command her.
Oh, sir, cried Oakes, I don't know how to thank you. I shall tell Clarissa that is to say, oh, yes, if you please. I'm reasonable good at navigation, and I believe I know how to handle a ship. Not like you, sir, of course, but tolerably well.
It shouldn't be too difficult. She's well found, and you'll have the monsoon with you. I shall, if all goes well, give you an acting order as lieutenant. And although she will still be a little short-handed, I shall let you have a couple of our master mariners, Slade and Gorges, for example, who can stand a watch and keep their own reckoning. The three French prisoners, too. They can at least haul on a rope. And I shall make an advance on your pay and prize money to bear your charge from Batavia home. Now, although the whole matter depends on our success the day after tomorrow, you would better go across and become acquainted with the True Love and her people.
May I tell my wife first? Asked Oakes, almost laughing with pleasure.
By all means. My best compliments wait on Mrs. Oakes. And let Mr. Reed know I should like to see him. The ship's boats were coming back in the darkness, having landed the very heavy material. They were hoisted in, and when the jolly boat was safely stowed inside the launch, for the small arms men and the gun crews were to be taken off at dawn by poor Lani's canoes by way of precaution, West reported to Pullings, who relayed the news to Jack, that all hands except two of the most notorious lechers were aboard. Very well, said Jack, and he went below, sharp set. At supper, he interrupted his steady attack upon the sea pie to say, I was never so surprised in my life. Just now I told Oakes I should give him an acting order as lieutenant to take the True Love in if all went well on Friday. He was amazed, delighted and amazed. His wife hadn't given him the slightest hint, yet she must have known it hours before from your questions. She is a jewel of a woman, said Stephen. How I value her. Jack shook his head and returned to the sea pie. Eventually, leaning back, he said, I never asked you what you thought of poor Lani. I thought her a magnificent queenly woman. Juno, with the same large, expressive eyes, and I hope without her faults of temper. She's certainly very kind. She set her people to work making a house for me to sleep in, but I told her that tomorrow night I must be right up by the guns. A silence for Pudding, and he went on, I don't think I told you how pleased I was with the war chiefs and their men. Thoroughly professional and well-disciplined. Not the least jealousy of the Navy, as you so often find at home. They were perfectly ready to take any suggestions I made, and I'd hardly mentioned a dressing station for you on a convenient shaded little plateau half an hour short of the cleft before they started setting it up. Half an hour short of the cleft? Yes, it's not the custom here to take prisoners, and I can do nothing about it. I expect something of a slaughterhouse, and I cannot have a battle of this kind interrupted for a moment on humane grounds. Have you ever known me interfere in any battle? No. But I strongly suspect you have a tender heart, and in such a case I think you would be far better in your proper place, which is a dressing station well to the rear, corresponding to the cockpit in a ship of the line. It was in this dressing station that Jack, Stephen, Pullings, West and Adams slept on Thursday night, having walked up the broad, well-beaten track smelling of crushed green that the carronades had taken before them, stubby, short-range guns that could be manhandled for this distance and on this slope with relative ease, they weighing no more than half a ton, three times less than Callahua's piece. And it was here, clearly, that Stephen woke at the first hint of light. His companions had already left, moving with that silence usual among naval men in the night watches. So had most of the warriors. But as he stood in the doorway, with birds singing and calling in the trees all round and below him, more tribesmen came hurrying up the path, big, brown, cheerful men, some wearing matting armour, all armed with spears, clubs, and sometimes dreadful hardwood swords, their edges studded with shark's teeth. They called out as they passed, smiling and waving. When the last had gone up, running not to miss the fight, Stephen sat outside the doorway in the rising sun. Presently the birdsong diminished to a few screeches here and there. They were not a melodious choir, upon the whole. And presently Padine succeeded in striking a light, coaxing a fire into being and warming the coffee. A number of birds passed close at hand, some of them probably honeysuckers. But still he waited, listening rather than seeing. Kalahua's campfires had showed clear last night, only an hour's march beyond the cleft. And even with the gun, the northern men and their white mercenaries should reach it before the sun had risen another hand's breadth. At intervals, he looked at it over the immense stretch of sea ending in a taut horizon. Immobile, of course. He tried thinking of that glorious Queen Puolani. It was said that her late husband, her consort, proved a man of inferior parts, and that she had him set in the forefront of just such a battle in the cleft. He tried repeating verses. But those which he knew well, which came easily, didn't overlay his vision of the sheer-sided defile 200 yards by 20, filled with men and they being fired upon from back and front and diagonally. The 24-pounder carronades would be using canister, about 200 iron balls at each discharge, and they would be served by expert crews capable of firing, reloading, aiming and firing again in less than a minute. In 5 minutes, 6 carronades would discharge at least 6,000 lethal shots into those trapped bodies. In his harsh, unmusical voice, he chanted plain song, which had a better covering effect. He had reached a Benedictus and the Dorian mode, and he was straining for a high qui venit when the clear, sharp voice of gunfire, carronade fire, cut him short. 4, almost at once, it seemed to him, and then 2. But the echoes confused everything. Then 4 quick hammer strokes again. Then silence. Padine and he stood staring up the mountain. They could make out a vague roaring, but nothing more. And the birds that had started from the trees below all settled again. Perhaps battle had been joined. Perhaps the carronades had been overrun. Time passed, though less slowly now, and presently steps could be heard on the path. A young, long-legged man raced down past them, a messenger of good news, his whole face alive with joy. He shouted something as he passed. Victory, no doubt at all. After him, several minutes after him, came 2 more, each carrying a human head by the hair, Polynesian the first, European the second. Both heads had their eyes open, indignant in the one case, perfectly blank in the other. Then, loud and clear, helped by some eddy in the wind, came the cry, 1, 2, 3, belay! And it was plain that a carronade was coming down the path. Long before it reached them, a group of small-arms men could be heard laughing and talking. And as soon as they came in sight, Stephen called, Wilton, how are many of our people hurt? None that I know on, sir, ain't that right, Bob? Right as dried peas, mate. And none of the Queen's men that I see, neither. But them poor unfortunate buggers in the gully, said the captain of the hold, an old shipmate of Stephen's and entitled to speak freely. God love us, sir. It was bloody murder. By this time the mountainside was alive with men, islanders, who knew scores of paths the guns could never have taken, most of them carrying their spoils, weapons, matting, ornaments,
ears.
Presently Jack appeared at the turning, with Bondon a little way behind him, looking somewhat anxious.
Stephen walked up the track, and as they met he said, "May I give you joy of your victory?"
"Thank you, Stephen,"
said Jack with a sort of smile.
"Are there any wounded I can look after?"
"All that didn't run away are dead by now, brother. Shall we take a side path? It'll get us down so long as we follow the slope and hit the Yahoo River. Tom is seeing to the carronades. Bondon, give Pardeen a hand with the medical stores, will you?"
They struck off to the left, a track that led steeply down through ferns to a little purling stream. The path was too narrow and abrupt for any conversation until the place where the stream ran across, making a pool under a spreading tree. Jack knelt down, washed his face and hands, and drank deep.
"Oh, that's better," he said, sitting back on a mossy root. "Should you like to know how things went?"
"I'm afraid it distresses you to speak of it at present."
"Yes, it does. But these things soon pass, you know. Well, the scheme worked perfectly, like a drill book. They were rather tired, having come uphill nearly all the way, dragging their gun and precious short of food. And our young men, posted at the far end to provoke them and bring them on into the cleft, had plenty of time to run back behind the guns and leave the field clear. I should never have believed case shot could do so much damage. I must say the French came on very well, leaping and scrambling over the bodies. Two rounds dealt with them. But even then Callahua's people rallied and charged with a shout, some of them almost reaching the guns before the last broadside. We stopped firing then, and those that could run, ran, pursued by some of Paulani's men. Not many, and they'll not go far, the war chiefs tell me, because of the broken country. We took their gun, of course, and I dare say Paulani'll get it down in time. After a pause, he said, "We only fired 10 rounds, Stephen. But there was a butcher's bill like a fleet action." And though the hands were pleased, of course, scarcely anyone raised a cheer. And it wasn't taken up.
"You didn't follow your plan of closing the other end, I collect, since some were able to run away."
"My plan? Oh, no, that didn't make very good sense. I was really trying to make your flesh creep, as you do mine with your surgical horrors. It's my belief, Stephen, that you do not always know when I am being droll." This was the first sign of a lifting, at least the superficial lifting of his depression. And by the time they'd made their slow and often mistaken way down to Paulani's village, he was perfectly capable of responding to their extraordinarily happy and triumphant welcome. He had been expected by the main path, through the sugar canes, where arches of greenery with 2 carronades under each had been set up. The Queen led him back by a sideway to the first, and then through the middle of all 3 to an immense sound of cheering and the thunder of wooden drums. Then he was taken from one group to another. Tapia, recovered from the throng, explained that these were the various branches of the tribe, and each group in turn fell flat, though not quite so flat as to hide their delighted smiles. The tribe had a great many branches, but the repeated ceremonies, the incessant beating of drums and blowing of conches, the feeling of great friendliness and affection as Paulani led him about, and the great beauty of the day, a brilliant sky and white clouds sailing evenly from the northeast, and the heat of the sun tempered by a charming scented breeze, set a barrier between now and the slaughter of the morning. And he walked into the Queen's house perfectly ready to be pleased with his entertainment. Here, the whole company, all robed, stood up as he came in, and to his astonishment he saw Stephen, Pullings, West and Adams among them, wearing splendid feather cloaks. And as he stood there, poor Lanny placed one on his shoulders, crimson from top to bottom. She smoothed it with great satisfaction and made a confidential remark. "She says it belonged to one of her uncles, now a god," said Tapia. "Any god would be flattered by such a cloak," said Jack, "much less an humble mortal." "It is a present," whispered Tapia. Jack turned and bowed, returning his best thanks. Poor Lani looked modestly down, an unusual attitude for her, and motioned him to a seat beside her on the bench, or perhaps firmly padded sofa would be the better description. A yellow-feathered Pullings was on her other side, Stephen in blue-black on Jack's left. And to him he said in an undertone, "Are you hungry? I've never been so famished in all my life. It came over me suddenly." Then, seeing Tapia whispering to an immensely tattooed chief beyond him, he said, "Tapia, pray ask the chief if Bondon can be sent back to the ship in a canoe to tell Mr. Oakes that all is well and that the boats are to come round tomorrow morning. I shall sleep ashore." Pulani's grandfather had acquired 3 ships' coppers. These vessels rarely appeared, since almost all Polynesian cooking was carried out with hot stones in an underground oven, the dish being wrapped in leaves. But now, gleaming like red gold, they were brought out by strong men and set on hearths in front of the house. An extraordinarily savoury smell wafted in, and Jack swallowed painfully. To distract his mind, he desired Tapia to tell the Queen how much he admired the orderliness of the gathering. To the right hand, outside the house, sat the starboard watch in due order of precedence, on the left, the larboard. All hands wearing garlands of flowers, while beyond them, closing the square, were the densely packed islanders. And on every hand, attendants were preparing food. As well as the coppers, 7 china bowls had reached Moahu, and these were placed on little cushions before the Queen, Jack, Stephen and Pullings, West, Adams, and an ancient chief, together with spoons and wooden platters of mashed taro. A chorus of conches blew 3 great blasts. Servants stood by the coppers, looking expectantly at the Queen. "Turtle on the left, fish in the middle, meat on the right," whispered Tapia. The Queen looked at Jack with a smile, and he, returning the smile, said, "Oh, meat, ma'am, if you please." The bowls were filled all down the line. The Queen had chosen to begin with fish, nearly all the surprises officers with meat. But it was exceedingly hot. And while they toyed with their taro, slavering as they did so, Stephen noticed the unmistakable helix of a human ear in his bowl, and said to Tapia, "Please tell the Queen that man's flesh is taboo to us." "But it is Kalahua, and the French chief," said Tapia. "Even so," said Stephen. And leaning to speak behind poor Lani's back, he said rather louder, "Captain Pullings, Mr. West, this is forbidden meat." When the news reached poor Lani, she laughed cheerfully, changed bowls with Jack, and assured them that his hands were in no danger. They were being fed on pork, which happened to be taboo to her. "So many taboos," she said, smiling still. And indeed, there were so many taboos, personal, tribal, national, woven into the texture of the island's life, that this little gaffe passed almost unnoticed, certainly without any embarrassment on the part of poor Lani. And the feast went on and on, most of the sailors soon recovering their appetite. After the fish and turtle, the best turtle in the South Seas, came fowls cooked in the Polynesian manner, dogs, eggs, and young fat pigs. All this with great quantities of Cheeves Carver, a more heady brew than usual. The feast, and there was a great deal of it, eaten over a very long time, was accompanied by singing, the music of flutes, drums of various pitch, and something between a harp and a lyre. And when even fruit would scarcely go down, the dancing began. There were some of the exactly timed evolutions and manoeuvres they had seen far to the south in Anamooka, and they were received with applause, but not with nearly such hearty applause as the much freer hula, danced with great skill, grace, and enthusiasm by a number of young women. "I'm glad Martin's not here," said Stephen in Jack's ear. "He could never have approved these licentious postures and wanton looks." "Perhaps not," said Jack. "For my own part, I don't find them objectionable, however." Nor did West. His appetite had been more severely checked than most by the sight of the Frenchman's ring finger in his bowl. But now he had recovered entirely, and he was leaning forward, gazing with passionate intensity at the second girl from the left. Jack did not object. Not at all. But sleep was rising up with such force that for some time now he hadn't dared shut his eyes for fear of dropping off, and more than off, deep, deep down. He stifled a yawn and looked wistfully at the stimulating carver bowl. The cup-bearer, too, was engrossed by the motions of the second girl on the left. Paulani caught his glance, reached out and filled him a bumper with kind, comforting, apologetic words. More conches, a great howl of conches. The girls withdrew to a thunder of applause with whistles and cheers from the frigate's crew, and to his surprise Jack saw that the sun was already dipping. Silence returned at last, and a figure, 8 feet tall, a man entirely covered with basket work, came into the square before the Queen. He had 2 drummers with him, one deep, one shrill, and when they'd beaten 3 measures, he broke out in a high falsetto of surprising volume, rising and falling to a rhythm that certainly existed for many of his hearers, since they bowed and nodded, but that neither Jack nor Stephen could make out. Tapia whispered, "He is telling the Queen's family right back and back." Again and again, Jack tried to seize the pattern, but always at some crucial point his attention wandered and all was to begin again. He closed his eyes to concentrate on the chant alone, and this was fatal. To his extreme confusion, he woke to find the whole table smiling at him. The wickerwork figure was gone, and already the fire showed red in the more than twilight. 2 powerful men heaved him gently to his feet and led him away. On the threshold he turned, as in a dream, and made his bow. Paulani, with the kindest look, returned it. Then there was a warm darkness and these sure hands. They took his feather cloak. He slipped off his clothes, and they lowered him onto the wonderful ease of the long, flat, soft couch in the house that had been built for him. He'd rarely been so tired, had rarely gone so very far down. Yet he rose up clear and fresh, no muddiness, no staring about. He knew, as a sailor knows, that it was near the end of the middle watch, and the tide was on the turn. He knew that there was someone in the room. And as he sat up, a strong arm pressed him back, a warm, scented arm. He wasn't altogether surprised. Perhaps his half-waking mind had caught the scent, nor at all displeased. His heart began to beat violently, and he made room.
First light was coming through the door when he heard Tom Pulling's agitated whisper.
Sir! Sir, excuse me, sir. The Franklin is in the offing, sir! Sir!
Pipe down, Tom, he murmured, pulling on his clothes. She was still asleep. Flat. Her head back. Her mouth open. Looking perfectly beautiful. He slid round the opening and they hurried down. The village was still asleep, apart from a few fishermen. Oakes had sent the boats in and already a second carronade was moving down over the rollers.
Mr. Oakes's duty, sir, said Bondon, and Franklin was seen in the west as soon as it was day. She stood in, doubted all was right, let fall her courses and steered southwest. She'll show round the headland any minute now, sir. And so he sent the drum. Very good, Bondon. Watkins, beat to arms. Doctor, Mr. Adams, come along with me. Captain Pullings, carry on.
As the jolly boat pulled out across the bay, the Franklin appeared, quite unmistakable. Long and low, a right privateer. She was suspicious, but not particularly alarmed. No t'gallants, and she hadn't even let the night-time reef out of her topsails. Jack felt extraordinarily well as he ran up the side. Good morning, Mr. Oakes, he said. Well done indeed. To Killick's mate, for Killick was still on shore, breakfast in 20 minutes. And to Mr. Adams, just arrived. Mr. Adams, pray write out Mr. Oakes's acting order in due form and the dispatches and letters we drafted. He glanced at the shore, where the laggard surprises were now hurrying about like purposeful bees, flung his shirt and trousers onto the capstan head and dived deep into the clear green water. Even after breakfast, the Franklin was obviously in two minds, for she threw out a signal, intelligible, no doubt, to her countrymen, a sign to which Jack, old in deception, replied with a vague hoist that went up and down. The halyard constantly jammed, wasting irreplaceable minutes. The carronades were coming home with incredible speed and their munitions. There was an appearance of hopeless chaos with people coming up the side from helping the True Love to weigh, very heavy weights being lowered, boats swinging inboard. But soon after Pullings had said, all hands have reported, sir, and the boatswain's chair is rigged, Jack turned to Oakes. Here is your acting order, Mr. Oakes, and the large wrapper holds all the other papers. So now, if Mrs. Oakes is ready, perhaps you should go aboard your command.
Clarissa stepped from the rail and said in her high, clear voice, please let me thank you, sir, for your great goodness to me. I shall always be extremely grateful.
He said, we've been very happy to have you with us. A prosperous voyage to you both, and pray give my dear love to England.
She turned to Stephen, who kissed her on both cheeks, said, God bless, my dear, and handed her to the boatswain's chair, which lowered her into the True Love's boat. He watched them go aboard and heard the shout, three cheers for the surprise, followed by, huzzay, 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 with all the force and conviction that the rescued crew could give.
Three cheers for True Love, cried Jack.
And suspending their work, the surprises answered, huzzay, 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 with great good humour. For many of them were very fond of Oakes, and all had the tenderest regard for their prize. Now the True Love was drawing away. Clarissa appeared at her taffrail, and she and Stephen waved.
All hands on board ship, called Jack,
and to Pullings, in a conversational tone. We can demolish the crow's nest as we go. Stephen stood there, while behind him the capstan turned and clicked to the usual cries. Each anchor rose in turn to the invariable orders and responses. And all at once he realised that the frigate too was underway, rapidly making sail and moving faster and faster eastwards after her flying quarry, so that the distance between the ships was increasing with dreadful speed. Before he was prepared for it,
The true love was no more than a remote ship upon the sea, and there was no longer any human contact at all.
The end. You've been listening to The True Love by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull.